It's time for three stories you should know. We've got a pair of college basketball stories this week. I'm joined by The Ringer's Kevin Clark and SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me back.
In an article for ESPN's The Undefeated this week, Jesse Washington has pointed out that although most of the competitors at the accomplished D1 men's basketball teams are African American, one group of players remains predominantly white. He's referring to walk-ons. These are guys who don't get athletic scholarships, but they sit at the end of the bench, and every once in a while they go in during a blowout and score a basket, and everybody gets excited. Why are walk-ons so often white? Washington cites economics. He says they're able to afford to attend school without a scholarship. And Washington quotes one of the black coaches who says, white coaches, and last season 75% of men's D1 coaches were white, that those coaches may have a tendency to subconsciously choose individuals that are like themselves. One of the white walk-ons, a guy at Purdue, has said, no, this is great. I meet lots of important people, and I'm going to get a great job after I graduate because the coaches will help me out. I don't know what we can do about this beyond working to increase opportunities for minorities in all areas, but maybe one of you has a more specific suggestion.
I think that with college sports, it is such a way to further your career afterwards. You know, everyone wants to hire someone who, like, oh, wow, you know, you played basketball at Purdue. It doesn't matter if you saw, like, 2 minutes of a game. It's still a thing where, especially hiring managers who often probably are men, are like, oh, sick, that's awesome.
Nice imitation. Very well done, by the way.
That's my hiring manager. Available if anyone wants to book me for stand-up. No, but I think it's sort of a holistic solution where you need to make sure that you have other people in the room who might not look like you. And I think that's true across the board and in all industries.
You know, the NFL had a similar problem where it was sort of a network of predominantly white coaches meeting predominantly white young people, and then they start promoting them and getting them through the ranks. And they started the Bill Walsh Diversity Fellowship Program, which was just basically any person of color could apply to get a low-level position at the NFL when they're young or after their playing days are over. And really, you just start getting exactly what is needed, which is entry-level minority candidates who then can work their way up.
One of the coaches quoted in that Washington article says, why do you think all the coaches are white? They're coming up through the ranks of those guys who walk on, who have plenty of time to watch great basketball and hence develop wonderful coaching instincts. Charlotte, I understand you have a confession to make this week.
Ugh, yeah. I wasn't going to do this, but I might as well just put it all out there. I like Duke basketball. Ugh. I mean, no one likes Duke basketball. And watching March Madness for me, I've always gotten excited when they've done well. And it's a weird situation because, you know, I didn't go to Duke. I couldn't have gotten into Duke if I'd tried. But a bigger sports fandom thing that this speaks to is how being a sports fan is as much about hating something as it is about loving something. And, you know, you can love your team, but hating the rivals, like, I hate the Yankees so much, and it brings me such pleasure to hate the Yankees. And so I understand that Duke is the villain. And they have the most hated players in college basketball constantly. Grayson Allen currently holds that title. But I do think that sort of owning the fact that I like this hated team was a little bit hard for me. I used to be embarrassed by it. Now I'm all in. I can't fight it anymore. And I'm going to go public with that.
I'm with you, Charlotte. Sports is about hate. I mean, it's so funny to me.
Kevin.
When I became a sports journalist, most of my allegiances faded to teams. But some of the teams I hated when I wasn't a journalist, I still hate. So I think hate can outstrip love in a lot of ways in sports. It's very beautiful.
I know people like hating the Yankees, and I have lived in the Boston area for a very long time, and I know I'm supposed to hate the Yankees. But I knew Yogi Berra a little bit, and I knew Joe Torre a little bit, and I couldn't hate those guys.
Right. But that's the thing, right? Like, I don't hate Aaron Judge. I don't hate Giancarlo Stanton. Like, I love those guys, but as a team, I can still, you know, hold on to that.
And the idea of the Yankees.
Yes, the idea of the Yankees and that sort of primal, ugh.
There it is again, that
there
sound.
There it is. I probably need to stop making that sound. I'm going to work on that.
Kevin, what have you got for us?
Well, I think one of the most important days in the history of modern football happened this week when Kirk Cousins signed a fully guaranteed three-year $86 million contract. Now, this is the norm in every other sport, fully guaranteed money, financial security, but you have to understand that in football, typically about half to 60% of the contracts for the absolute superstars are guaranteed, and in many cases, no money is guaranteed. And basically, Kirk Cousins spent 2.5 years plotting to get this contract. And it's the first of its kind, obviously. And if you look at the next wave of quarterback negotiations, Aaron Rodgers is coming up soon. Matt Ryan from Atlanta is coming up soon. They might ask for these sort of guarantees. And then the entire game changes. Does that trickle down to lesser known quarterbacks? Does that trickle down to non-quarterbacks? And so it could end up being that Kirk Cousins, and this is no overstatement, one of the most important players in NFL history because he changed the labor market that much.
I think that it does change the sport. I also can't imagine what's going to happen when Rodgers is up or when Matt Ryan is up because these guys are better than Cousins. And, you know, like what do you do when you have to guarantee that much more money? And what does that do for the rest of the team and the rest of the cash that you've left for players?
What I would like to see, since you're talking about contracts that would change the game entirely, I would like to see a contract where a team guarantees that it will take care of whatever medical issues a player encounters throughout his life, including care in the home for ALS and consequences of assumptive CTE. Kevin, will we see a contract like that in my lifetime?
So, unfortunately, the teams have pushed that. First of all, you know, since the new CBA happened, there is better after-career medical care for players. But for the sort of late-in-life CTE, ALS-type treatment, a lot of that has been pushed towards the concussion settlement, which was initially $760 million and has risen considerably. However, it's basically a nightmare of red tape right now. And so teams are going to push that off and say, hey, the league already settled that, go through the settlement. But the settlement at this point isn't good enough just administratively.
Still, it would be great if some one player with the kind of influence that it would take would be able to get a contract like that, because that really might change things.
No doubt. And it will take someone better than Cousins to change that. I mean, that would have to be Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady saying, OK, I'm not going to play unless you guarantee me this.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Kevin Clark and SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder. Thank you, both of you.
Oh, just a delight, Bill. Thanks so much.
Thank you.